Good morning. It's so wonderful to be with all of you, both in person and online, and our two special visitors. It's special because you showed up, and it's special because all of us showed up. For the close to about 2.5 months, we've been having periodic talks about some of the notable Indian ancestors that, especially ones that for different reasons have influenced the practice we do today. So I'd like to urge you to not get caught up in the dusty shelves of history and see how these ancestors contributed, and their contributions have come through the centuries down to us. So this is vitally relevant for our practice. Today, I'm going to talk about a little bit about the life and mostly about the teachings of a 14th century scholar monk named Vasubandhu. I'm going to say a few things about his life, but only for the purpose of kind of explaining how his particular life influenced his work. Vasubandhu, along with his half-brother Asanga, according to the traditional stories that come down to us, are known for developing a school of thought and practice called Yogacara. Yogacara. Yogacara existed as a distinct school in India for over 500 years, and it was eventually absorbed into a number of the Buddhist traditions in Asia and now around the world, including Zen. And due to its influence on Zen, I'm going to mostly focus on what Yogacara is and its influence on our own practice right here at Blue Heron and Golden Wind Zen Centers. As I alluded to before, I want to mention a couple of points about Vasubandhu that influenced his work. He was born and raised in an area where what we might call early Buddhist practice was dominant. This is the kind of practice that still exists today. One of the schools that still exists is Theravada. You might have heard of insight meditation. Some people practice in a forest monk tradition. They certainly do in Asia still. And some of the people have brought that to the West as well. So he was brought up in this, you know, centuries after Buddha's lifetime, but still largely practicing in the way that Buddha taught. By the fourth century, Buddha's original Sangha had splintered into a number of separate schools, and each one over the centuries had differing opinions and beliefs and doctrines. This is a natural occurrence after Buddha's lifetime, as practitioners struggled and disagreed over issues that hadn't been fully addressed to their satisfaction in his teachings. So this brilliant young man who became a scholar monk was determined to reconcile the conflicting views of these early Buddhist schools. I can't recall, I've heard everywhere from, at this time there might have been 15 to 20 to 24 different schools, each with slightly different ideas about what's real, what's not real, about, well, a number of things. So Vasubandhu took on this huge commitment to reconcile the conflicting views among these early schools, and he became widely known as a young monk for his rather bold critiques of competing doctrines. Pretty incredible in its own right. Going forward later in his life, it's said that Vasubandhu's older half-brother, Sangha, had converted to the Mahayana. So the Mahayana is what Zen is part of. Tibetan Buddhism is part of the Mahayana. These are the teachings that appeared in the early centuries of the Common Era. And this is when the experience and concept of emptiness grew, interbeing that we might have heard of, the fact that while you and I are separate, we're also, that's not the whole story. We're also not separate. Paradox. But paradoxes are true. So Vasubandhu eventually began following the Mahayana. So here we have this brilliant mind who's been born and raised in the early tradition, tried to get to the root of the truth of what Buddha was driving at to help ease our suffering and help us wake up in this world. And the Mahayana. And they dedicated themselves going forward to integrating the entire tradition of Buddhism. Pretty incredible. They also, and this is an important part, addressed two of these questions that I mentioned before that had eluded the Buddhist thinkers over the centuries. First one is, why do we persist in viewing the world in terms of self and other, when Buddha's very first insight was that there is no permanent self? Think about it. Some of us have been practicing for a couple of months. Some of us have been practicing for a few years. Some of us have been practicing for 30 years. I've been practicing for about 30 years. And I still largely think of the world in terms of me. This is no problem because in the day-to-day world, this is the custom. This is the way we do it. But it can also create immense suffering for ourselves and for others, because we compare ourselves to others. As soon as we split this unity that Buddha pointed to and was pointed out by the Mahayana thinkers, where we are also one, this prevalent insistence that seems to be hardwired into our brain is that I am me and you are not. So it's natural for us to try to protect this me from other. Or if this me deep down inside feels like I'm not happy and satisfied with my life, I might start wanting to get some of the stuff I think I lack. The traditional ones are money, sex, fame, sleep. That's included, believe it or not, et cetera, et cetera. We all know that. So many of us have decided we're going to be the most famous, we're going to be the richest, we're going to be all that. And social media certainly is showing us that that's a prevalent view. And then some of us realize that that isn't really satisfying us either, and we come back to the Zen Center. So first question, why do we perceive that I am me and the world is not? And then the second question is about karma. Everyone believed in karma in the Buddha's days, not just Buddhists, not just Brahmins, not just Hindus. It was assumed, sort of the way that probably somewhere between 99% and 100% of the people in Europe and the West believed that there's no previous life, but there's an afterlife. But we can see karma going, moving from generation to generation to generation. So these questions about where does this karma come from haunted people. We want to tame our karma. We start out wanting to get rid of our karma, but if you've been around for a while, somebody's probably kindly tried to break it to you that it's going to stay with you. But can we do something that that sort of loosens its grip on us, our thoughts and our behaviors, and we find some kind of peace in it? Can we go so far as to say we could even make friends with our karma? It might seem like too much, but we can certainly get to the point where we say, oh yeah, I see you, I know that. Well, you know, you're not my favorite, but you can hang around, just don't stay too long, and be on our way. Then we can become more and more free from it. So all of these two questions that I belabored a little bit were addressed in Yogacara. So just quickly, Yogacara simply means the practice of yogis. Not like the yoga studio where most people do the body movements and also try to find peace, but it's a full lifelong commitment to living ethically, perceiving the world in what's called wisdom, which in Buddhism is thought of as seeing that you and I are two, but we're also one. So it's all, Yogacara is also called consciousness-only Buddhism. And I want to only point this out because it doesn't mean that the only thing that's real is consciousness and, you know, all the stuff we encounter and perceive day to day are not real. It only means that everything we experience is experienced through the mind. So Yogacara is looking at consciousness, how it works, addressing these questions that people felt unsatisfied with. So these are the two questions that we address here every day. And when you go home and practice at home, you're working on these same questions. The first one is to help us understand how consciousness functions so we can tame the thoughts that cause suffering for ourselves and others. And the second is Yogacara shows us how the conditioning that we inherit and the conditioning that forms during our lifetime distorts our view. That main one, I am me and you are not. And also our view of how we perceive things. We're always perceiving things through the filter of our conditioning. So Yogacara is working with that and also ultimately pointing out ways we can wake up, quote unquote, to our true nature. All right, Yogacara, has, I would say, a well-deserved reputation for being complicated. It can take a lifetime to master. And what I'm hoping to do today is really just limit our investigation to an innovative model of consciousness that appears in one of the, probably the most well-known writing of Vasubandhu. And this writing is called 30 Verses on Consciousness Only. And they're 30 short, usually two-sentence or three-sentence verses. I've already talked about this, but the 30 verses begins by addressing this most basic source of human suffering, which we've already talked about, the persistent habit of perceiving the world in dualistic ways. I am me, that is not. So that pertains to human beings, animals, objects, ideas, beliefs. And I'm going to read you the very first verse. I'm not going to read all the verses because we'd have to order in for lunch and dinner, probably. The very first verse says, everything conceived of self or other occurs in the transformation of consciousness. To be honest with you, when I first read that phrase, in the transformation of consciousness, I was like, what is he really saying? And after looking into that more deeply, it's another way of saying that everything changes. This is one of Buddha's insights. He thought he was looking for a permanent self, and he only found constant change. So that constant change, we are not in the middle of constant change. We are also constant change. So this transformation of consciousness that this translation uses really just means our consciousness is in a state of constant change. We've all experienced this. Very first time, I'm not a betting man, but if I was, I would put like a shiny dime down on the floor and say the first time you meditated, what you noticed mostly was the fact that our mind is just bouncing around like some kind of highly charged atom or ball. And it's so common that, you know, we use this phrase, that's our monkey mind. That's our monkey mind. What that is in the context of Yogacara is this changing consciousness. So through practice, we learn, we'll get to that, but we learn to do our meditation in a way that helps calm that down. So Vasubandhu is saying that all of our ideas about self and not self occur within this flux of consciousness. But how does it work? In the next verse, he identifies what he calls three aspects of consciousness. These he lists as the imagery of sense objects. That cushion is blue. This floor is yellow. I hear this kind of faint buzzing. Before we even identify what it is, our eyes see blue, our eyes see yellow. Our ears change. The second aspect of consciousness is consciousness of a self, which we've already spent time on. This split that we create somewhere. And what he calls the ripening of karma. And this is really his investigation into these questions around how karma works. So I want you to remember that although we're going to explore these three aspects of consciousness individually, they all work as one. Where he's splitting them into three so we can actually investigate each one, and then we can see how they all work together to bind us or liberate us. So the first aspect that Vasubandhu points out, the imagery of sense objects, is this process of experiencing so-called objects using the traditional six root senses of Buddhism: eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind. When I was a kid, we only had five, but Buddhism includes mind because, and this is just the perception that kind of appears, quote unquote, in our consciousness. But this is really just about observing data before we identify, right? Before the idea of me and you even kicks in. There's this direct perception in this present moment. Second aspect, the conscious self, we already talked about. And here's the juicy third aspect that addresses karma. These last two, the investigation into self and other, and the investigation into karma, are Yogacara innovations. So Buddha, during his lifetime, addressed the six root senses. In fact, it was called the all, because that's what he based his teaching on. But in Yogacara, Vasubandhu and other thinkers added two more. So Yogacara has eight consciousnesses, and why don't you go ahead and pass out I prepared a little chart for all of you online. Our stream master is going to share a screen. I've gone against sage advice from my lifelong teachers and Master Jibong and our co-teacher and Pope Sanim, never to hand out something while a talk's going on because everybody stops listening. So I'm asking you to just refer to it. It's not that complicated, but I think just seeing them broken out into these three aspects can keep us from getting confused. So the first six we've talked about. The seventh consciousness is given a name, and I know a lot of you don't want to hear all these obscure names, but it's called the manas, and it's this aspect that separates self and other. So what Vasubandhu is doing is he's admitting that this is something that is part of our consciousness. And sometimes you hear teachers and other students talk about thinking mind, before thinking mind, after thinking mind. The manas is where this kind of thinking takes place. And for some of you who might have practiced in other traditions, it's sometimes called the observer or the witness. This thing that's, and I experience that constantly for many years when I was practicing. There was this guy, Eric, who was like right here behind me, watching every move I make and wondering what my problem is. And, you know, I heard so much about non-duality. Oh, I had the most amazing non-dual experience. I'm like going, I don't think that's ever going to happen for me. This dude will not let me rest. But over the years, it faded away. And it faded away when I stopped worrying about it. It'll persist. It'll try to fool you into thinking it's never going to leave. But it can fade away. The eighth consciousness. Should I use the word? Alaya Vijnana. You don't have to remember that because it has a nickname that you can always refer to it. And that's the store consciousness or the storehouse. And it's a metaphor that starts to make sense of this. The storehouse describes how the past colors our perception of the present moment, moment after moment after moment. This is telling you where karma comes from. It's a brilliant model for how karma works. And the storehouse is said to drive the entire process. So we're going to spend a lot of time on the storehouse. This is also where I really want to remind you that this model that's put forth in Yogacara is not meant to convey any kind of universal truth of how the universe operates. It's a teaching device to help you see how these eight levels of consciousness, or consciousness as a whole, can keep you in a state of suffering and as a result cause collateral damage around you, how it moves from generation to generation. And also how we can become free of that. So just remember, this is only here and put forth to help you in your practice, in your life. So unlike the other seven types of consciousness, the storehouse is hidden from our view. It operates subconsciously, so we cannot observe it in action. We can only observe the after effects, and that's why it's so difficult for us to perceive our own karma. When you see it, for example, is when you're meditating and you find yourself, instead of staying on whatever your practice is, your mental practice, you all of a sudden, some, let's say, traumatic memory from the past comes up out of the blue. This is the after effect of the storehouse, processing karma, processing the conditioning we've inherited and the conditioning that continues as we go through our life. So we have, there's a fork in the road from a practice point of view that's really fascinating. We can think of the store as the repository for our conditioned mind. It's said that all the seeds of our past karma are stored in this storehouse. You could think of it as a silo. You could think of it as a garden with all these seeds lying dormant in it. Seeds of all kind. Seeds of that time, you know, you blew up at Uncle Charlie on Thanksgiving. or seeds of when you paid attention and noticed that maybe an old person who was quite frail was standing ahead of you or behind you in line at the grocery store, and you said, hey, why don't you go ahead? That plants seeds, new seeds, that are wholesome and helpful. So it can go either way. I want to take a minute and use anger as an example. So anger is just one. I think we're all familiar with anger, right? It's a universal thing, but this can be any kind of karma, good, bad, or indifferent, to fall into that opposites world. We all feel anger arising from time to time based on certain conditions and certain situations. It's a natural emotion, and we're in no way, shape, or form trying to prevent anger from arising. But how we respond to it, whether we do it reactively or responsively, can make all the difference. For many of us, we first learned how to respond to it within our family structure, either from our parents or, who all probably also learned it from their parent and your grandparents and your great-grandparents. This is the kind of pattern that gets passed down. And I'm just going to share on a personal note, in my family of origin, my brother and I learned it primarily from my father. He and I still unfairly perhaps, but also accurately, referred to him as a rageaholic. He blew up at everything. When he was angry, his pattern, his behavior was common. His face and eyes would redden, he'd clench his jaw, and he would stomp around the house while it built up to a boil, while we walked on eggshells during this process of smoldering. And it would build up until, of course, it exploded in a fit of rage. This is the classic, my dad blew his top moment. And fortunately, it wasn't, there wasn't a physical component, but there certainly was a lot of mental trauma for everybody. My mother feeling helpless to keep this from happening from herself and her kids, my brother and I, but also my dad, who lived in kind of a hell realm because this karma ruled him so much. So let's look at how Vasubandhu's model of the storehouse fits into this. The sparks of anger that lead us to think or act in a way that causes suffering causes the storehouse to, they use the word perfume traditionally, but water or nourish these dormant seeds of anger among all these kinds of karmic seeds. And they will ripen and bear fruit. So it was an agrarian world at that time. So everybody knew how seeds worked, and they grew into plants and they bear fruit. And then the fruit falls to the ground and more seeds are created. Vasubandhu uses this model to describe that whenever we act in a way where we go into a point of volition where we say or do things that unleash this anger on the world, it establishes a pattern of angry behavior. So a karmic habit is unfolded. I lived in Boston for a number of years, and I met friends of mine who grew up in houses like this, and they had a different model. It would flare up, and they immediately go to a bar and punch somebody out who they'd never met. This was a repeated pattern that's really tragic. And you could, I got to know some of these people as they were trying to tame it. And they said, that's the way our dad showed us. And that's the way his dad showed us. This is how you take care of it. And then there's rationale that gets passed down that this is the way you do it. You got to do it because why? You got to be a man. This is the manas. This is the self-making aspect of consciousness. You got to be a man, or you got to be polite and nice, even when people walk over you. Whatever those things operate this way. He also spends some time in some of the verses comparing the process of the storehouse to a river. So at sometimes it's placidly drifting along, and other times, after it tumbles over some rocks, it becomes a raging torrent. So he's illustrating this constant flux. And I should also mention that the storehouse, according to Vasubandhu, is neutral, agnostic. It's not making judgments about good or bad or indifferent. It's kind of a factory or a factory farm, maybe, right? Where it just processes this stuff. We don't know how or why. We don't know what it perceives. We don't know where it's located. But he's putting forth this. So this flow of karma is always, always changing. Never remains the same. And the karma that comes up is always unique. It comes from our conditioning, but the karma that ripens and bears fruit is always brand new. So in this way, the storehouse really affects the manas, as I alluded to. And remember, the manas is exactly. You guys got it. Thank you for that. So when a karmic habit becomes deeply ingrained, the manas associates that particular habit with its so-called self. As a result, we start defining ourselves consciously according to some of these karmic habits. Oh, I'm an angry person. Hi, who are you? I'm an angry person. We do that. Or I'm a spineless pushover. Or I'm stupid. Whatever room I walk into, I can tell you right now, I'm the dumb one. I mean, tragic. But in truth, what we're experiencing is this bubbling up of consciousness. So because of the profound influence the storehouse has on all eight aspects of consciousness, it's crucial for us, and this is something that I would love for you to really take to heart. It's crucial for us to become more intimately aware of our thoughts and feelings in the present moment. This is our laboratory in which we get to do this experiment. If you're on a retreat, or just earlier today when we spent those 20 or so minutes meditating, you might have had thoughts of grandeur. And what could be more pleasant than thoughts of grandeur? So my back's getting a little sore, my knees are kind of bugging me. I think I'll just hang out here. This bubbles up. And when it gets out of control, we feel like we are king or queen of the world. Not good. So we call this a leaning mind. Our mind leans towards thoughts when the manas creates this desire mind. And so we lean towards it. I want that. I am king of the world, so I have to find the most sexually attractive partner, no matter who gets in my way. and I have to have them behave in a way that suits my idea of my worthiness, for example. The leaning mind also leans away when aversion kicks in. These are bad memories, or replaying that weird interaction we had with our boss yesterday. What was that all about? And we go around and around and around, and we usually start either questioning what our problem is, or we just export it to that person who, you know, has always been a jerk. So noticing when our mind is leaning away toward, or when it's simply neutral, it can reveal to us where our thinking has become attached. And it's in these moments when we can influence the storehouse and the manas in a beneficial way for us and consequently for the world around us. So over time, again, thinking about our meditation, when we find ourselves indulging in our superiority or our inferiority, new karmic seeds are formed and they deepen that trauma. On the other hand, our training, the very simple style of meditation that we do here, is designed to respond. What we do every day at home and what we come and practice together at the Zen Center and on retreats. So instead of indulging desires or trying to escape from aversions, we observe them come and go freely. In the words of Vasubandhu's very first verse, all notions of self and other occur in the transformation of consciousness. It sounds too easy, but it's simply our consciousness bubbling up. And we can be aware of that by observing that it's changing all the time. We can practice with it. We can be really brave when a really traumatic thought comes up and blows our fuse. If it's really tough, we just fasten our seatbelt and hang on. But if we find ourselves getting kind of irked at something or entertaining these old ideas, these labels that we carry around with them, we simply, as soon as we notice that, for however short or long a period of time, when we become aware of it, we don't push it away. We just come back to our practice. So that brings us back to the six root senses, where we're just observing the change that's going on around. What do I see? What do I hear? Or that's also eye making. Let's rephrase it to what sensations are our eyes bringing into our mind before we identify even them? Just a sense of light, dark, color. Listening is a great practice. Very simple, but it's a great practice. Even when it seems to be really quiet, there are sounds coming on, and they always bring us back to the present moment. Breathing, which I know is a little tough for some people to get the hang of, but our breath is always fully present in our body. And it's where our body, our mind, this sack of bones and blood interact moment by moment with the universe. So every time we find a way to meet whatever arises in our consciousness in a responsive way without taking in the revenge part of the story or the depression start of the story, which is also a real tough one. We are actually fostering wisdom and compassion. The storehouse starts watering, nourishing seeds of compassion and seeds of connectivity, which is the whole point. I know this has been just a ton of stuff, but when you really, if you can break through this aversion a lot of us modern practitioners have to lists that come out of Buddhism, and look beyond it and see how your own consciousness works and see where you can actually do something that's beneficial or reinforce things that cause us problems, it's going to really make a difference in your practice. All right? Thank you.